We're ready for the first case, Sheck against Barnhart. Mr. Daly.
Good morning, may it please the court. Frederick Daly on behalf of the plaintiff, appellant, Tina Sheck. First of all, Your Honors, I'd like to thank you for granting my motion to have the case heard early. The reasons I gave in the motion, I appreciate it.
What event does your son run?
Oh, there's a mile run today at LaSalle Language Academy for the 7th graders, so
good luck.
Thank you. In this case, the administrative law judge denied the claim where the claimant had two disabling back impairments, two separate impairments. One was the lumbar, herniated disc in the lumbar region, and then he had spinal stenosis, C4, and 5, and severe spondylolisthesis and C3, C6. He had to elect to have surgery on one or the other. He elected to have surgery in the lumbar region because he had difficulty walking even to the bathroom. Could not have surgery on both at the same time. The administrative law judge totally overlooked the cervical condition.
But could we back up? Because it seems to me that what the administrative law judge was concerned about was the dearth of evidence that would have shown that prior to December 31, 1994, his conditions were actually disabling. I mean, there certainly is evidence in the record that he'd been having back problems, but they're all manner of back problems, as you know. And it was thin at best, and on substantial evidence review, how can we second guess that?
Well, it isn't thin if we have MRI evidence in 1993. Of severe cervical and lumbar conditions. Only the lumbar condition had surgery. And in 1997, in the record of page 275, we have that same cervical condition. There's been no surgery for it. In fact, in the MRI, it stated that these findings are stable since our previous exam of April 1993. And a treating doctor, a surgeon, under 404.15.27, is entitled to the greatest amount of rate of weight, and controlling weight, in fact, if his opinion is based upon medically acceptable techniques. MRIs are medically acceptable. He's a surgeon. He's a specialist. There's no contradictory evidence in that record whatsoever from any physician.
But Mr. Sheck never followed up after the 1993 operation, so we don't know, you know, whether that really did relieve his pain enough to allow him, let's say, to do some sort of course, this ALJ never gets to step 5, but had he followed up, we just have so little information here.
Well, the information, though, is strong as far as objective evidence. And the opinion by the treating doctor, when he looked at all of the MRIs, and his opinion was that the symptoms that Mr. Sheck was stating were reasonably related, that he needed to get that cervical surgery to release the problem that he had with his upper extremities. The follow-up, according to the plaintiff at the hearing, was the follow-up was not for the laminectomy in his lumbar region. The follow-up was to discuss surgery for the cervical condition. He decided when he spoke, and he spoke on the phone with the doctor, and they decided that since his lumbar surgery was not successful, and he was having such severe problems and even sitting and walking, and he had to lay down, or he said he was in a reclining position for 80% of the day. So because of that, he went with the conservative treatment for the cervical and wanted to let it sit for a while, and then he got the cervical surgery in 1997.
So, but he has the burden of proof, doesn't he, at the first four stages of the test.
And the opinion from his treating specialist is proof. And it's under 404.15.27 and 96.2p. You can't have better proof. You have objective evidence, clinical evidence, and a treating doctor, the surgeon, the person who actually operated on you, give an opinion about your condition going back to 1993 and forward. And he performed surgery in 93 and in 97, and the man had two separate conditions, and you have MRI. You can't have any stronger opinion from a doctor. There's no requirement that Mr. Sheck had to go see a doctor for those 8 months from 93 to 94. In fact, when you get into the credibility determination, the ALJ used only the fact that there was no treatment note. And she based her credibility findings solely on there being no continuing objective evidence prior to the date last insured. She did not use the 96.7P factors, the 8th Circuit Pulaski factors, the 7th Circuit Jarowski, all the 96.7P criteria that is necessary in making a credibility determination.
Right. By the way, do you think this case is governed by the 8th Circuit standards or our standards?
Well, I think that because the hearing was in the 8th Circuit, the law of the 8th Circuit was being applied, but I think it doesn't really matter that much because when you take Pulaski and Jarowski and 96.7P, they all kind of say the same thing. You have to take into consideration more than just the objective medical evidence. You have to consider the other seven factors, and she didn't do that.
Well, she's concerned with what she sees, not just from the 93 to 94 period, but from the 89 to 93 period about what she describes as the dearth of
right.
evidence.
If he was granted benefits as of his date last insured, we wouldn't be here. 89 to 93 isn't that important.
Okay.
I think sensing the weakness in the credibility finding, the government did argue on page 37 of their brief that Dr. Heiselman's opinion is undermined by Mr. Scheck's own admission that he did relatively well after the 1993 laminectomy, referring to page 196, which is Dr. Topol's report. What Dr. Topol actually said was that Mr. Scheck said that he did relatively well until 1993, not after 1993. And all of the evidence in the record, all of the testimony from Mr. Scheck, doesn't point towards the fact that he could sit down and do a sedentary job. He indicated that he was in great pain, he got Valium, took ibuprofen every day, reclined most of the day. I mean, at one point he said in his answers to the interrogatory, you know, I get up in the morning, I look out the window, I pet the dog and say hi to the bird. You know, I mean, he had no life. And he had before that a very successful job. The administrative law judge found that he could return to his highly skilled work. She referred to it as sedentary, yet he testified that he stood and walked for 4 hours, which is not strictly sedentary. And you know, he testified that he would love to return to a job, but that he just couldn't do it under the circumstances. Thank
okay,
you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Daly. Mr. Sanchez?
May it please the Court, Alfred Sanchez appearing on behalf of the Commissioner of Social Security. Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to highlight two important considerations or issues in this case. Of important, critical importance to this case is the fact that it involves a date last insured issue, meaning that Mr. Scheck filed his claim under Title II of the Social Security Act and therefore bore the burden of establishing that he was under a disability prior to the date his insured status expired, which was December 31st, 1994. The additional consideration is that Mr. Scheck bore the burden of establishing that he was unable to perform his sedentary work prior to his date last insured, again, which was December 31st, 1994.
So why should we think that if he had a certain cervical condition in 93 and it was the same in 97, that there had been some curve in which it had gotten a lot better and then it slipped back and gotten a lot worse? That's not really what final conditions are like.
Well, I think if we look at the record, and we'll see that on page 196, Mr. Scheck did say in 1997 that he did well for the most part after his 1993 surgery. When he spoke to Dr. Topol in 97, he indicated that it wasn't until 1996 that he began to feel some weakness in his leg. That kind of undermines his argument that before 1994, he was under a disability.
But Mr. Daly, maybe we're thinking of different statements of Mr. Scheck. He just said that that's not really what he said to Dr. Topol. And in fact, he was talking about his pre-93 condition. I guess that arose rather quickly, right? All, it was a couple months before this April surgery.
Well, before 1989 and 1993, his 1993 surgery, there was a lack of medical evidence to establish any sort of back impairments or any ailments. In 1993, Mr. Scheck stated that 3 to 4 weeks prior to that surgery, he spontaneously developed back pain.
But Mr. Barron just told us we don't need to worry about 1989, that if we could even get something up to 94.
Following that 1993 surgery, Mr. Scheck did indicate to Dr. Topol that he did quite well, that he did well after that surgery, and in fact, he reported that there was no weakness in his leg. And then we have this period from 93, the next medical evidence in the record is 96, and he's telling Dr. Topol that he didn't experience weakness in his leg until 1996.
But what if he has, even though no weakness in the legs, excruciating pain in his upper body? Is that something we disregard?
That's not something we disregard, but looking at the record as a whole, it doesn't establish that Mr. Scheck was unable to perform sedentary work prior to his date last insured. It may establish that he would have some functional limitations, and the ALJ did accommodate those functional limitations in her residual functional capacity finding.
But how in the world could she have said, if she did, I found this a little remarkable, that he was capable of lifting 50 pounds? I mean, she goes through these various tests under the statute, and at the top of page 9 of her opinion, she says, based on the evidence, Mr. Scheck had the residual functional capacity to perform the full range of medium work, capable of lifting up to 50 pounds at a time. I mean, that seems just fantasy on this record.
Well, the ALJ is looking at the record as a whole. She's looking at the objective medical evidence in the record, and she's also...
What scrap of evidence indicates that for a man with the problems that were not addressed in 93?
Well, again, Mr. Scheck bore the burden of proving that he was under a disability. He bore the burden of providing medical evidence, detailed medical evidence, to enable the ALJ to make an informed decision on his disability. There's nothing in the record at that time, during that time period, that indicated to her that he would be unable to perform medium work. And she considered the fact that he spontaneously developed his back impairment prior to his 1993 surgery and accommodated those functional limitations as a result from 1993 to his date last insured in 94 and limited to the light work. And, you know, again, we're looking, she found at step 4 that he's capable of performing his sedentary past work based on the evidence of record. There's nothing in the record to establish that he would not be able to perform sedentary work prior to his date last insured of December 31st, 94.
Well, nothing is an overstatement, is it? We have testimony that his condition was stable. We also have his subjective testimony about what he was doing, his daily life, which is evidence the commissioner takes into account, his pain, the kinds of medications he was taking.
Well, Mr. Scheck did provide the agency with physicians which he believed would provide medical evidence that would establish that he was under a disability.
Right.
Elmer's Hospital provided that they did not have any medical evidence for him since 1987. Gottlieb Hospital, which is the hospital that Dr. Heiferman is affiliated with, that doctor made the 1999 opinion about his disability, indicated that they did not have any records from Mr. Scheck between April 1993 to October 1997. And Dr. Shallot, also with Gottlieb Hospital, confirmed that there was no records from April 1993 to 1997. So it can be inferred from those records, or from the lack of records, that Dr. Heiferman could not closely follow Mr. Scheck's condition, and that when Mr. Scheck's condition did deteriorate and get worse, that he finally did come back and see Dr. Heiferman so he could have a subsequent surgery performed. But that was well 3 years after his date last insured.
Okay.
Thank you, Emily.
Thank you very much. Mr. Daly, anything else?
There's really nothing in the regulations that say you have to be closely followed. But what the regulations say in 404.15.27, 404.15.29, is your condition must be reasonably related to, you know, your subjective complaints must be reasonably related to the condition, and the regulations state in the credibility criteria that you must follow your treatment, whatever treatment regimen it is. There was no treatment regimen that Dr. Heiferman gave that Mr. Scheck did not follow. It was basically surgery that was not entirely successful. On page 196, where Mr. Sanchez quotes from, he just doesn't say that he was better after 1993. He said that within about 2 months it began to reoccur again, never became severe enough in the lower back as it had been prior to his surgery, but he testified as to how his condition was. It was surgery that improved him slightly, but it did not bring him back to good health. They refer to his past work as sedentary, but yet as he performed it in the record, he had to stand and walk for 4 hours. So the administrative law judge would have to find that this individual can stand and walk for 4 hours every day, despite these impairments that he had. I think that's too much, even in Social Security ruling 8320, and here we have evidence going from 93 to 97, so it's a little bit different. We're in a better position because we don't have to infer as much. But even if there had been no MRI in 1993. Under 8320, a medical expert can come to a hearing and say, well, I look at these 1997 MRIs, and they're severe. And those statements that he's given you from back in 1994 when his last insured expired are reasonably related to what he and his wife are saying his condition was. And that's allowed under the regulations. It should be allowed here. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel, and we will take the case under advisement.